You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rick Rogers. Rick, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we got kind of a jump start here. So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, the things you've done? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
So, you know, I've thought about this a lot since I knew I was coming. And I think in terms of to think about who I am, I realize that I also think about this a lot. I'm a teacher, I'm a storyteller, and I'm a children's author. And those are three aspects of my life that have driven and motivated me through my entire adult life. The only other little, I wouldn't say little, but part of it is having been drafted during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So almost my entire adult life, I've made my way, have made my living focused and working with children in those capacities as a teacher, a storyteller, and an author. Mm-hmm. And so and then the military experience has affected the decisions that I've made and in my capacity as a teacher and a writer, more importantly. Mm-hmm. And then the other, with looking at my work as a writer, so a little quick story, remembering that being a storyteller. I'm a storyteller of the ancient oral tradition. So almost all my work, I made my living 18 years as a professional storyteller, doing almost all public school and public library. That's where I did my work. Mm-hmm. Part of it is because when it comes to storytelling, I'm really more myself around children than I am adults. Because I'm a teacher. I'm an elementary school teacher at heart.
Kids are your crucible.
So when I'm with children, I let myself be a little bit more me. Mm-hmm. And so I found that originally when I kind of stumbled into the storytelling, I was most comfortable in quiet settings where I did not have to use any amplification or electricity. And so I was drawn to the public school library. Mm-hmm. And also my writing is about the woods and the out of doors. So, and which, what my stories are about. And a lot of that has to do with simplicity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is kind of what drives my living habits and also my work, the way I view my work as a writer and a storyteller. And so I think that what's important for me to share is that I have a memoir that I recently completed. It's called Teaching as Adventure Training. And actually, I should phrase that. It's a memoir autobiography because as a writer, I wrote religiously in a journal almost every day for 19 years. And so when I retired from the classroom in 2011, to go back to writing, I felt that as a teacher, I had many experiences that I wanted to share, thinking more about young people who might want to become teachers and what it can mean if you're focused on children or young people. And so in that autobiography memoir, I'm starting to lose my train of thought.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to put, what did you want to put together in that?
That by being focused on children, that it can open doors for us. And thinking back about then being able to share examples of that through my life's story that I had in these 19 years of keeping a journal. Mm-hmm. And so going back and looking at that, it enabled me to try to share examples from my own life on how working with children can make a difference, and also how it can affect us personally.
And how it makes you as a person.
How it makes us as a person.
Right.
And so when I guess what I was thinking about is I was trying to think about these questions that you had suggested we think mm-hmm. about, and kind of like the nexus of these moments in our lives that, you know, have guide us or have shaped us. And so when I think about that, I set out to be a teacher, mm-hmm. my teaching career in 1972 after I got out of the Army because I had been drafted. But thinking about being a teacher, I, from my background, you know, from, you know, SUNY Fredonia, where I did my mm-hmm. bachelor's work, one of the seminal works I remember was Summer Hill. And that in Summer Hill, I think it's A.S. Neal, it's been a long time. Mm-hmm. One of his points was that as teachers and as adults, as parents, we have to remember that we can talk all we want, but it's the modeling that's important. Mm-hmm. If you want children to be honest, you have to be honest.
Right.
If you want them to be nice, you have to be nice. And so I knew then that I had to try to live the way I was trying to, the things I was trying to share
sure.
with children.
Sure.
And so just a quick story, if I could. In my third year of teaching, my 10-year year, I decided, you know, when I got out of the Army, I realized I was never pledging flags again, and mm-hmm. I haven't since. But I've always been respectful. So even as a classroom teacher, because kids say the pledge every day, I was mm-hmm. standing in the back of the room and watching these sixth graders, you know, half standing, half sitting, and thought, I got to do something about this. So I bring up about, you know, why do we pledge flags? I mean, why do we do this? And so the kids and I, we have this conversation, and I say, well, maybe you ought to go home tonight and talk it over with your parents. And, you know, if you don't believe the words or whatever, then, you know, I don't know, think about it. So this one charming young sixth grade girl, Ann Pavlock, goes home, tells her parents, Mr. Rogers says I don't have to pledge the flag.
Which isn't quite exactly what you said.
Not exactly what I said. Next thing I know, I'm in the principal's office. You know, here's this guy. He's a World War II bomber pilot. You know, my principal, Bob Schaefer. And he, you know, he wants to know, why are you doing this? And basically what this leads to is it's my 10-year year, and the representative of the superintendent gets called, you know, I get called into the office with this guy, and he basically says, look, you better change some of your ways, because by then I'd stopped looking like a teacher. My right. hair was growing and, you know, everything. I stopped wearing a tie and all that. And so that's when he basically says, you better change your ways, or I can't guarantee that you're going to be granted tenure.
Sure.
So now I have to go home in my little apartment in Kenmore and look myself in the mirror and say, I'm just a kid from Central Florida where I grew up. I'm lucky to become a teacher. And here I am in Williamsville, this prized school district. And all they want you to do is cut your hair, start wearing a tie again, and pledge the flag. And am I going to give all that up? Just be, you know,
right.
And then, of course, from my military experience, I know that all we are is what we're willing to stand up for, because mm-hmm. we know that on any given day, everything that's precious to us, that's meaningful, can be taken away.
Can go away.
It sure, can sure. go away.
Sure, sure.
Either by angry men or acts of history, you know, natural history and Mother Nature
coming
into our environment, and kapoof, it changes.
Right, right.
So for me at that point, you know, being a veteran, I'm thinking, what do I know that's important? And it's the principle that's important. If we have to live by our principles, and that's all that matters. So I have to stand up for what I believe in. First of all, if I cut my hair and then I go into my classroom the next day and the kids say, hey, Mr. Rogers, how come you cut your hair? And I say, well, I was afraid to lose my job. Where's my credibility? So I, you know, I'm not going to do that. And as it turns out, they deny me tenure,
mm-hmm.
which in New York State, you get denied tenure, you might as well forget it.
Right.
But because what they did basically was illegal, they couldn't deny me tenure because of my politics.
For a non-related cause, yeah.
The parents came out to the school board. I mean, I was so overwhelmed with the
support.
Response
sure.
from the you know, the mom said, we don't care what he looks like, you know, or his politics, leave him alone. And of course, then they had to eat crow and give me my job back. But by then, I had already decided that I knew I was in the right profession, but the wrong place.
Sure.
And I give up my teaching job in Williamsville to strike off to seek my fortune in a rural area. And then, you know, the story just goes right from there. Yeah.
And we will pick it up. But let's take a break from music. What you wanted to open with some Michael Franti.
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about that or just play it?
Well, Yell Fire is the CD, and there's a song on Yell Fire, which is a little bit, it was a little bit heavier, but I thought this was kind of knowing your background and mm-hmm. and what you represent. I thought this song is more inclusive. It's more, it's a little bit more of a Sunday feeling to it.
Okay. And so, this is East to the West.
East to the West.
Here we go.
Never gonna stop.
Never gonna stop.
To the east, to the west.
East to the west.
To the north and south.
To the north and south.
To the east, to the west. One love, people never gonna stop.
One to creation, one to the sun, one to the morning, one to the one.
One to the air and the freshness we breathe in. One to the force of the change in the seasons. One to the mother from which all things come. One to the daughters and one to the sons. One to the father who helps us believe that nothing's ever gonna harm you seeing. One to the soldier who walks city swamps. One to the soldier who fights overseas. One to the man who gets down on his knees and prays for guidance and protection reasons. To the east, to the west,
to the north and
south. To the east, to the west,
one love, people never gonna stop.
To the east, to the west,
to the north and
south. To the east, to the west,
one love, people never gonna stop.
One to the woman, one to the man, one to the culture from the time when it began. One to destruction, one to birth. One to the people who still fight for the earth. One to the people who suffer for their needs. And one to the rebels who love rocking to the beats. And one to the healer who fights a disease. And one to the Lorax who speaks for the trees. There's no amount of money and no amount of man can bring back to life what's gone when it's done. And one to the people who rise with the sun. And one to the people who sleep when it's gone. To the east, to the west,
to the north and south.
To the east, to the west,
one love, people never gonna stop.
To the east, to the west,
to the north and south.
To the east, to the west,
one love, people never gonna stop.
This whole thing seems upside down. The whole wide world keeps turning around. This whole thing seems upside down. The whole wide world keeps turning around.
Life is too short to make just one decision. Music too large for just one station. Love is too big for just one nation. And God is too big for just one religion. One through the practice of being in the flow. And one through the tears of the things we let go. And one through the moment we live in right now. And one through the east, west, north and south.
To the east, to the west,
to the north and south.
To the east, to the west,
one love, people never gonna stop.
To the east, to the west,
to the north and south.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rick Rogers. So, Rick, when and how did you become aware that you really wanted to live a vocation as a teacher and storyteller and writer? What kinds of things did you need to go through to come to that kind of understanding? When did it become clear to you? How did it become clear to you?
Well, the teaching, I just got lucky that when I was 17, my father who was an automobile mechanic, I think he felt my future might be brighter if I was in a different environment. Mm-hmm. And so he suggested I move up from Florida to move in with his niece and her husband, who were both teachers. They were in their early 30s. They didn't have children. And they took me in at the end of my junior year of high school. So my senior year of high school, I think the purpose there, I think my dad could see I wasn't inclined for mechanics. And so
it wasn't floating your boat.
It wasn't floating my boat. And I think he would get impatient with me because I couldn't. I mean, my dad was one of those guys. He could do everything, plumbing, electrical. And I just.
He was a hands-on kind of guy.
Yes. And I think I couldn't, you know, figure stuff out fast enough. So wisely, I think, and to his credit, he suggests I make this move from Florida to upstate New York. Now I'm living with two teachers, and they can kind of see that my academics is lacking. I mean, at that time when I was 17, 1965, I was working at a grocery store as a bag boy. I figured after high school, I'd probably go to work in the produce department or something and right. work my way up. Now I'm with two teachers, and I mean, I can remember the morning sitting there having breakfast or supper. I guess it was supper, and, you know, eating my pork chop. And they said, well, like, where do you want to go to college? I was like, are you talking to me? It wasn't something that in my thought pattern.
Right.
Kids like me didn't go to college. And that's, of course, you're going to go to college. Why wouldn't you? Anyway, I struggle, you know, through Onondaga Community College. And, of course, the nice part about it, of course, is that the purpose of the community college was like kids like me.
Right, right, right.
Give me a chance to learn how to read and write. I go to Fredonia. And I become a teacher, I guess, because I'm living with two teachers.
Right, right.
And it's like, oh, this is nice work.
Right.
And I, you know, I mean, I didn't really do much with children, but it seemed like it was a good match for me. However, my mom was Cuban, so I was a Spanish major up to the end of my junior year at Fredonia because mm-hmm. Spanish came easy to me.
Sure.
So that kind of kept me afloat, actually, because I struggle with a lot of other things. But then I decided I didn't want to be a Spanish major. I wanted to be an elementary ed major. So anyway, I graduate from Fredonia. I've got my degree, but then I'm drafted. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, here's the Vietnam War. I get very lucky, though. I don't get sent to Vietnam because this is 1970 when they're Vietnamizing the war. Of course, I don't really know this at the time because right. like most boys that age, I'm ignorant. Mm-hmm. I don't really know U.S. foreign policy and why we're in Vietnam or anything. I just know I'm in the mix. And at that time, of course, they need to get Nixon reelected in 72. So they have to withdraw, you know, lower the U.S. body count, and they intensify the technological destruction. So hundreds of us get sent to NATO and Europe. Mm-hmm. So I spend 2 years almost in Europe as, you know, as a... in the army, but I'm trained as a journalist. I go to the DINFOS, Defense Information School, just by a stroke of luck, which is a long story. However, I'm trained as a journalist, so now I'm writing.
And you're a storyteller.
And I'm a storyteller.
And you're a
writer. Now, I don't know I'm a storyteller at this point. Not yet. But I am learning that writing now, because I have to do it all the time.
Sure.
Like any skill, you have to do it a lot. You get better at it. So now writing just kind of is more a part of me. And so then when I get out of the Army, I get a teaching job in Williamsville. And this is what I mentioned before about sure. the Pledge to the Flag. But I'm a single guy. I have a little apartment in a house in Kenmore. And I'm spending all my time basically in my apartment or in my classroom.
Right.
And so after in my third year around in there, you know, I can remember... on a snow day. And I've always been this way as a teacher. I always like to get in my room early. I was usually always in my room by 6:30, 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And if it was winter days where I knew like it was going to have
classes start at 8 or later
or yeah. later, okay. Or if it looked like there were going to be a snow day, I would get there early anyway. Cause I knew if I was already in my room and there was a snow day, I'd be in my room and I'd get a lot done because it'd just be me.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So I remember one day, it's a snow day, I'm sitting in my room and I'm looking at this book, of a social studies book. It's called Man, A Course of Study, where it was this really neat program where it just looked as humans as a species. Mm-hmm. Very colorful. And I'm looking at all these photos of people from all around the world and I'm sitting on my desk and I'm thinking, gosh, you know, if I stay here, I'm look at all these things I'm not going to see or I'm going to miss. And I'm thinking, you know, because I'm probably going to meet a woman. I'm going to get married and we'll probably be both teachers. And, you know, I remember looking out and seeing the homes outside my classroom window. And this is Williamsville. So most of those homes are doctors, lawyers, CEOs, you know, they're professional class men and women. And I'm thinking, is this really what it's all about, though? I mean, I'm going to work my whole adult life so I can live in a neighborhood, in a house, and get a couple weeks off to take the kids to Disney World. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I think maybe it's time for an adventure. And if I'm going to do it, I better do it now.
Right.
So after my fourth year, I give up my job. And I realize if I'm not a suburban urban guy, because that's part of the thought. I wasn't going to museums. I didn't go to ball games. I basically spent my time in my... I loved being a teacher. I
mean, right.
What's not to like about being paid to do bulletin boards and draw, you know? So I thought maybe I'm a rural person. So that's when I decide I'm going to just give up my job and go to Maine, get a job maybe in a rural school. Mm-hmm. But in the back of my mind, I'm also thinking, you know, here you're in a pretty progressive community. They tried to fire you because you don't pledge the flag. You don't look like a teacher.
Sure.
And if I go into a rural community, it's going to be more conservative. So what can I do so I can still work with children? And I thought, why don't you write stories? Because I really thought, you know, writing stories about the woods and the out of doors, and that way I can, still be with kids, but kind of be independent. Mm-hmm. And the little point to this that I'd like to bring out is part of my philosophy is sometimes very little things that we hear or see or read can make a big difference in our lives. And I remember reading Newsweek magazine at that time in my little apartment one Saturday night about a writer who spends time with wildlife biologists. Then he takes the experience back to New York and he writes articles. He makes his living as a writer, writing about natural history. So I thought, well, gee, why can't I do that? So when I'm on my way to Maine, I just go to the University of Maine, park in the parking lot, walk into the wildlife department, and I start asking around, hey, is there any PhDs doing wildlife work that I can, you know, meet? I meet this Ed Soutier. He's doing his field research on marten. And he says, of course, you can go with me. I'll even pay you. You can be a technician. So now I'm, you know, now, of course, what I don't know is this is going to open some really magical doors for me, because it's when I'm in the North Woods with Ed Soutier on this, studying his live trapping marten, the four-legged predator, that there's a woman who operates the base camp. And she wants to know kind of who I am, because she knows I'm not I'm not a student at the University of Maine. And then I tell her, well, I'm a teacher and I want to write stories about the woods. And she says, well, gosh, do you know that the old loggers in the old day, when they died, they turned into birds called a gorby? And I think, oh, that's a great idea for a story. Uh-huh. Later, when I start trying to research that story, it takes me into, I don't know it, but this is going to open the doors where I'm going to eventually learn that I'm a storyteller of the ancient oral tradition. And so it was just the magazine article. And also, I think, too, part of it is from my military experience was that I think what happened in Williamsville is the same thing that's happening in Maine, is that if you want something to happen, you have to make it happen. If you put the energy out there, that it might not evolve the way you're expecting it,
right?
But it will open doors. You have to be willing to pursue whatever it is that's floating your boat, whatever it is that's moving and driving you. And if you do that, then there are forces out there, unbeknownst to us, that will begin to open doors that we don't expect.
Right, right. And I'm going to play with your language just a little bit here, because this is a very powerful story and it's one we don't often take apart. In a certain sense, you're as much a hard worker as your father was. And you describe getting to school, or I mean, I don't, maybe he wasn't, but that's the way that's the impression that I get. And you're to school early, you're school on snow days, but you don't have like a focusing goal. And a lot of people confuse having a focusing, not having a focusing goal without having a sense of purpose or direction. But when you are available to what you're intuiting, what you're kind of sensing out, perceiving, not projecting, not judging should be, but rather perceiving, then you see the doors open. But it's more of a result of how open you are to just let your life unfold rather than to force it through a particular box,
right,
or a particular opening. And that, right, you know, we don't often think about that, especially where we've tried to groom children to achieve rather than to perceive and just go with what is an opportunity in the moment. And that's just neat.
Yeah.
And to believe in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in thinking about when I started telling stories, I was really doing mostly, I wasn't telling my own stories mm-hmm. yet.
Sure.
I was doing a lot of the old fairy tales, because the old logger that I met, who was going to influence me, that would, to why I would realize that I was a storyteller,
right,
he did a lot of the old fairy tales that he could remember from when he was a kid.
Right.
So
now, and he anointed you.
He anointed me in his own way without
yeah.
knowing it.
Yep.
And so what happens basically is I'm working as an outdoor educator, and I'm crossing the country, and I wind up in central Illinois and as an outdoor educator, and I wind up meeting a librarian who has a $10,000 grant for a storyteller, but no storyteller. And I had started sharing, after I left Maine, I was working with in these outdoor education centers, and I was telling, because I knew that I had these old fairy tales that I had made copies sure. of these old stories the way he had told them. And I had started sharing them around the campfires with the kids. And of course, you know, in these camp programs, it's like, hey, we know Rick can kill about half hour to 40 minutes a night because he'll tell stories.
Right.
And so I'm learning.
And that, he's good for a week.
He's good for a week. And I'm learning, like, wow, I'm starting to see, like, I could get in front of a group of kids and parents mm-hmm. and tell a story. And there's something begins to happen that I'm, you know, I don't know. I'm sure. just telling this story. So anyway, now I meet this librarian. She's got a $10,000 grant for a storyteller and no storyteller. And I say, well, I don't know if you can call me a storyteller, but I've been telling stories around campfires. So now she hires me on this grant. I'm not making a dime from my writing. Every story I'm writing is going nowhere.
Right.
Now I'm making $10,000 as a storyteller on this grant in Central Illinois, but it's forcing me.
In their mid-1970s, when that was some serious money.
Yeah. And so now, because it's a library, three-county library system, and any nonprofit who wants to have me come, like as entertainment, they just call up.
Right.
So now I'm going to VFWs. I'm going to, you know, Kiwanis's. Mm-hmm. I'm going to church socials. I'm going into schools. And at that time, I'm just doing all the old fairy tales. And of course, I can't, if I go back to the same place, I can't tell the same stories.
Right.
So I'm on this grant, so I have time, and I'm constantly, for some reason, I like the fairy tales. I don't know why, but I'm attracted to the genre of the fairy tale. And we know that fairy tales are folk tales, but not all folk tales are the fairy tales.
Sure.
The fairy tales basically are the Märchen. They're the old, that the Grimm's brothers collected, mm-hmm. these ancient old stories. Well, I'm reading so many of
archetypal
them.
Conflicts and archetypal characters.
Yes, with some very common themes like perseverance. Mm-hmm. You know, if you persevere, no matter how difficult the odds, no matter how scary the dragon,
or how many fingers or limbs you lose,
you will come out the other side. Yep. And now I'm realizing that this is kind of working its way into my thought processes, mm-hmm. and I'm beginning to accept that this is true, that if you, like with the storytelling and my writing, that if you don't quit, you don't give up, you just keep pushing and you keep working, or you keep pursuing whatever it is, at some point, the doors are going to open. Right.
As long as you're eating and sheltered along the way.
Yes.
Those are the signs that you need to turn a different direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
if you land a place where you can't eat or sleep.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And of course, at the same time, I'm still I'm in outdoor education mm-hmm. settings, and I'm still working on my own writing, which are stories from my outdoor experiences now that I'm gaining because I'm doing a lot of outdoor ed.
And the way you're probably crafting those stories changes because they're being impacted by the fairy tales.
Yes. Yeah, and you can see, of course, I know as a writer, and as you may know, when we think of Joseph Campbell, his work as an anthropologist, that it's this, of course, I'm making my living as a storyteller. It's like, who does this?
Preachers.
Who gets, sorry, yeah, right. Who gets paid to tell stories? So I realized there's magic in this. Yep. You know, there's something going on, and I'm also learning that the power of story, mm-hmm. that I can, all I have to do, Rick, is just get up there, whoever the group is, and just start telling a story. And before long, something starts happening where I'm just the mouthpiece for the story. But the listeners, they're not seeing me anymore. Right. They're off into that world wherever we go when we are listening to stories.
Listening deeply, fully.
And it's powerful stuff, right. Which is why preachers have used it for a long time.
Right. But also, this was in the mid-70s when you came into this awareness. And we were about 50 or 100 years out of the assumption that almost every, to be a human being is to be a storyteller. Mm. You know, or to have some serious story chops, because that's what it means to be with one another, is to take each other places through our stories that we wouldn't otherwise go. And you don't have to travel. You don't have to burn a lot of fossil fuels if you're a really good storyteller or a good story listener. Because you go there, like you just said, in terms of that you could watch them go there.
And I begin to also feel that this is a guide for mm-hmm. me. This is allowing me to do what I also really want, which is to write. And eventually, it's the storytelling that pays the way, because I'm not making a dime from my writing, but I'm being paid to tell stories.
But you may be finding your literary voice as a storyteller.
Yes. And it's the writing of the stories about the out of doors that I know that to be authentic, I have to live where I want my stories to come from.
Right.
So now I'm spending a lot of time outdoors. I bumped into this guy at Jeffrey Gale, who is now a premier basket maker. And he and I we begin to look for land together, and we wind up buying a piece of land in the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas. No electricity, no running water. It's got 60-foot rock bluffs. And I wind up spending a lot of time there because that's the heart of my work as a writer, mm-hmm. but to make my money.
That's your field work.
That's my field work. And it's also there where I realize it's living outdoors close to the earth is something that moves me. And even though I'm a man of the 21st century, I would have been much more comfortable living 200 years ago.
Sure.
Because the simplicity of the closest. And I also began to realize that I have a lot of Native American sentiment and attachment to mm-hmm. the earth. And as you mentioned earlier about, you know, you can do anything as long as you have food and water. And we also begin to learn that it doesn't matter who we are. You test take us for a couple of days and throw us out there in the natural world.
And you find it.
Woohoo! Your life, because what we do, we start, it gets real simple. Food, water, shelter, and a place to poop.
Yep.
And basically, that's about it. And Mother Nature, you know, as I know as a science teacher, when I, you know, as I go back into the classroom, we know that this earth, you know, life, it's complicated, because when you think about the ecology of the earth and all the living things, but at the same time, it also is very simple in terms of what our needs are when you remove us from all the material trappings of modern society.
Right. And things can be as simple or as complicated as our need for precision makes them. You know, big words are not necessarily bad words. General directions are not necessarily bad directions. Right. But we oftentimes want to split the hairs put a too fine a point on it.
Yeah. And technology, I mean, I went through a, probably I wouldn't say an eccentric phase, but when I first met Julie, I didn't want anything to do with electric. I mean,
you didn't just go into the hills, mountains, you rejected what you left behind is what I'm hearing a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's part of that's also part of the process of claiming your own myth and living out its consequences.
And thinking about, who we are and what's important to us. And, and so, eventually, it's the storytelling that I pursue on my own after I left the grant. I thought, well, gee, if I could make it on a grant, why can't I do it myself? So I go back to Florida, hanging with my parents. So because I'm living in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, no way to make any money. I got to make money somewhere. So I start going back to my parents' home in Florida and I start trying to make money as a storyteller in the schools. And I'm also writing. And eventually I wind up being able to self-publish my own work as a self-published author. And
you use your storytelling as time to hawk your wares.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wind up actually so what I start doing eventually is I'm doing school programs as a storyteller and author, but I'm doing mostly original material. I also am doing music because I found that, as a transition as a storyteller, mm-hmm. to go from one story to another, music is great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Especially Jeffrey Gale, the guy I mentioned, he went with me originally and he would play the dulcimer and all of that. So I thought, ooh, wow, that works. So anyway, I'm able then to go into a school. I get a fee for doing the school programs. And then the next day I'm able to go back and they put me in the library and I'm able to sell my books to the kids directly to them in the school libraries. And I do this for almost 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the magic worked.
Right, 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 right. Let's take this moment to cut for music, and I'll do the station ID while you pick what we play next. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rick Rogers. What should we play next?
Well, you want to do the Spider and the Hummingbird?
Sure. Sure.
So...
do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Yes. So one of the things I wanted to share is, even though I'm making my living writing stories for children and telling stories for children, my adult work is basically war. All my reading that I'm, mm-hmm. when I'm not focusing on children, is U.S. foreign policy, because at one point I decide I want to write a young adult novel, and that young adult novel is about my military experiences. Mm-hmm. And so I start to delve into the Vietnam War. So almost everything I'm reading when I'm not doing something with children is about our destruction in Vietnam. And I also reach a point when I'm down by myself in the Philkins Creek reading about Richard Nixon and Henry Kiss of Deathinger, that I just want to get my hands on these guys. And knowing because of our spiritual connections to the earth and what's important, that I can't allow these thoughts to dominate because it's too negative. So that's when I would train myself, when I would catch myself thinking too much, to do something for children. And so then I would make myself come up with a children's song. So one morning, sitting on Falcons Creek in a summer kitchen, seeing a spider who's made a web overnight and then a hummingbird coming by, I have to take my mind away from Richard Nixon in Vietnam.
Right.
And I go into this song for children.
Here we go.
One, two, three, four. Morning. spider and a hummingbird in the air. Spider in the morning, in the morning feeding. Spider in the morning, in the morning air. Sliding down the web to the center feeding. Sliding down the web for her fair share. Center waiting, sliding down the web, I saw her there. Little brown moth was caught and straining. Little brown moth would disappear. Saw her green little hummingbird in my ear. Over by the flower she swerved and hovered. Nectar of the flower she gathered there. Ruby-throated hummingbird, close I saw her green little hummingbird in my ear. By the daisies I watched her flying. Over by the flower she hovered there. Early in the morning feeding. Early in the morning air. Spider and a hummingbird, they were feeding. Spider and a hummingbird in the air.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rick Rogers. That was Spider and a Hummingbird, one of Rick's children's songs. So what, how do your, in the Spider and the Hummingbird song, you set it up so that the spider does what a spider does. It eats another animal. And it's violent, but it's not gratuitous violence. And it's not about controlling a universe beyond their immediate space. It's just about owning the space that they live in. That seems just so kind of intuitively appealing. And I'm wondering, you know, is that what re-centers you after the egregious violence of war and global control and environmental destruction? I mean, I'm kind of asking it in a leading way, and I don't mean to be doing that, but I'm just struck by the difference between the two experiences that you shuttle between.
Yes, and because we know that the natural world is a difficult place, and yet at the same time, it's this phenomenal universe that
it's we awful. Live
in. It can be awful.
No, I mean awe-filled. I'm saying it's awful.
That's right. It's full awful. Awe. And so, in it's how I ground myself. So, you know, and one of your questions, like how do I ground myself, or what do I do?
Right.
And so it has sort of what you were talking about. So, every day, as much as I can, I call it my outdoor physical spiritual hour. Now, as in almost all my adult life, I have made it a point of living in the country, and I like humans. I just limit my contact. And of course, it's easier now that I'm not in the classroom anymore. But then again, when I did have contact, it was mostly women teachers and children.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but on a daily basis, I try to get out and I walk or I run, and I spend time outside. Let's say that's different than working in the garden. Mm-hmm. It's more of going, putting my, you know, pushing myself a little bit more physically, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I'm outdoors where I can. Of course, I'm fortunate to live up on a mountaintop where I can go out my backyard,
sure.
and there I can look across the valleys. And if I pretend that there's nothing else out there, it looks like it probably could have hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. But it grounds me in, I guess, for like a sort of meditation where I can allow my mind to connect me to the earth around me, so I can think more about, you know, the trees and the snow and the crows and that. It's, you know, just part of who we are. And I guess it's part of who I am,
right.
because I feel, I know that I'm, you know, so I know I'm a mammal, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
Right.
You know, I, you know, we're just mammals and we're just part of this planet and part of this earth, and that it's all this wonderful scheme that somehow has come about where it's all tied together, but yet it's also based on predator-prey relationships. Mm-hmm. And if you don't keep your act together, if you don't pay attention, if you're not taking care of yourself, it's also designed so that you might very soon, sooner than you think, wind up back in that soil.
You'll be taken out.
You're going to be taken out, but then again, you're going to be reintroduced. All those body fluids yes. are going to go right back into the soil, which means another flower is going to grow. But yeah. And I think that's also probably, you know, like with my stories, I try to share some of that interconnectedness, mm-hmm. but in a manner that's it's real, but yet at the same time, that we can feel good about our place.
Right. It's not for its shock value.
Right.
And a lot of the times, the inherent violence in predator prey relationships are told more for their shock value and their threat than for their just the matter of factness. I want to come back to a question we haven't got to before we go more into your self-care. And that is, and I'm going to frame it three different ways, and you can pick the one that sticks. How has life surprised you and turned out differently than you expected? Or how have you had to change in ways that you would not have anticipated or chosen? Or what may have forced you to change a deeply held commitment, and you found that that was really worthwhile? These are the tough change questions, not the easy ones. Yeah.
So, I guess if I have to think about a change, I will have to say first of all that I don't change easily.
No, and you don't change quickly. I assume from the way you move.
And I don't change quickly.
Right.
But I've been able to live my life the way that I have wanted, mm-hmm. by making the choices that I've wanted to make, so that I've maintained a degree of control.
Right.
So
you learned that Sinead O'Connor song, I do not want what I cannot have. Hmm. Learning
right.
how to want what you can have
yes.
is a very powerful
and
lesson.
Also to follow the my... So just some quick examples. Number one, thinking about when Julie and I, we had gone to Nicaragua during the Contra War.
Sure.
And we went there because I felt as a writer, even though I was really making my living off my children's stories, a lot of my writing, of course, we were living outside of Ithaca and outside of Candor, it was the adult stuff. And I felt that mm-hmm. as a writer, if I was going to continue to write about what was going on in Nicaragua with the Reagan administration, that I really, as a writer, I really needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Julie, you know, she said, well, if you're going, I'm going too.
Sure.
So we wind up going to Nicaragua during the Contra War. And it's so there's a pursuit there that moves and drives me that I feel is important. And we are able to go and we spend 2 months traveling in Nicaragua. We come back and we're very moved, of course, by the Sandinista Revolution. And when Bush and Reagan destroy it, I feel like by then, I've been reading so much about Central America, mm-hmm. Vietnam, I can't take it anymore. And we decide we're going to leave the country. and we just take our son, who's only two, and what we can carry on our backs, and we go to live in New Zealand, and we leave, and we're not coming back, because our commitment is to the planet and the earth, and so we go to New Zealand, and we live there. I get a green card as a storyteller. And, you know, I wasn't intending to come back, but family is very powerful. Mm-hmm. So we do come back. And so another time when, you know, a decision is very important that moves me mm-hmm. is before I meet Julie, I had met a teacher in Central Florida, and I was going back and forth from the mm-hmm. Ozark Mountains to live and then to make my money in Polk County, Florida.
Sure.
And I meet this woman and I'm living with her, and I realize the only way I'm going to get back into to go back to the mountains and stay is to make more money. And one way to do that is to go back into a classroom as a teacher. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do that. And of course, having a beard and a hair in Central Florida, but then they know me as a storyteller mm-hmm. in Polk County schools.
And you're allowed to look weird when you're a storyteller.
Being a storyteller. and a principal offers me a job, a first grade job. And of course, my mom and dad are thrilled. You know, I'm with this beautiful woman, and I'm not living where there's no electricity anymore. And right. they're just right. happy as can be. I last 3 days. The first day I'm in there as a teacher, it's wonderful. I'm around these charming women who my colleagues and these kids. And I walk out, and it's in a building where I told myself I would never work with children in Florida. They built these schools in the 70s and 80s with no windows. Because if you keep no windows, yeah, cheaper air conditioning, and it's warmer in the winter. And now I'm taking a job in a building without sure. windows. 3 days later, it's like, I can't do this. Right. I got to go. Right. And so I give up the job. And my dad is like, what are you doing? I said, I got to go back to the Ozarks. He said, you don't have any money. I said, I know. He said, you don't have a job. I said, I know. What are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I'll worry about when I get there. I go back to the Ozarks, and I wind up finding a bunch of families who need a teacher for a one-room school. And now for the next two winters, and it's in the one-room school that it gives me the time to actually put my first book together.
Sure.
So a lot of it is that whole, you got to stand up for what you believe in. You got to do what mm-hmm. you think is right. And of course, it was a little easier for me sometimes, because not being a materialist, I never really owned a whole lot. I could just, but I kept it that way.
You travel light.
Travel light.
Yeah. Travel light. So I'm going to take the time spent outside, not gardening, is where you engage nature. The time spent gardening is probably where you are doing a slightly different kind of engagement. The openness to travel light means that you can kind of, at the drop of a hat, change course. That's a little harder when you own a home and you have a career and a pension.
Like well, I do now.
Right. But and you're living off of that.
Yes.
The success of that. So that it has bought you time to do things that you value. In the next 2 or 3 minutes, what do you do take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, and physically? You've mentioned a bit of the physical stuff, but what do you do to take care of yourself?
Well, of course, we try to eat right. I mean, one thing about Ithaca, but with sure. Green Star, and even with Wegmans, I mean, Julie and I, forever, we've always mm-hmm. tried to be as organic as we can.
Sure.
We grow a nice big garden, so we eat a lot of healthy food. And I try to stay physical, as mm-hmm. I mentioned. I also try to work out. I mean, I know that I have to take care of myself physically. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the spiritual connection to being outside. And I also I'd spend all my time reading about politics and everything. And now, as I've gotten older, I realize that I just can't, you know, like choice theory. I only control what's around me. I can read about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and what we're doing around the world. I don't have any control over it. Mm-hmm. So stay focused on what I actually have control over. So I limit the amount. I mean, I used to listen to NPR constantly. Now right. I just limit it. I more listen to music when I'm cooking. Mm-hmm. And so that I'm also allowing my mind to be more calm.
Right, right.
And less focused on thing, because there's a lot going on out there, as we sure. know, climate change sure. and everything, and then to stay involved. I'm on the school board. I'm still engaged with teachers and children, and having a purpose, and which helps, I think, take care of me mentally as well as physically.
Cool. I don't know if you can do this in a minute or two, but self-care is something you kind of were drifting as a kid. And when did you become aware that self-care is something that you have to do?
When I first started teaching, I started catching myself as an adult growling at the kids. This is my first year of teaching.
Yeah, right.
And I realized that this is not self-actualization. If I'm angry and I'm coming home, and that's when I thought, well, what about yoga? So, So for 40 something years, or however many years, when I first started teaching,
right,
in this outdoor physical spiritual hour, I do a yoga routine because I know that it's important. With yoga, it's mind, allowing the mind to rest, and then you're also stretching the body and the muscles and everything. And
sure.
So that's been part of my workup for. Long,
so
many,
it was,
many
it
years.
Was you're aware that anger was poisoning your space.
Yes. Yeah.
I could have used that lesson a little earlier in life. Rick, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Well, Eric, thank you for inviting me. It was nice to bumping into you again.
So, what would you you had mentioned a song, Capercaillie, Blackfields. Do you want to close with that, or the other Michael Frante, or
let's do the the Springfield. I think that's a bit.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Sure. And do you want to say anything about it before we play? Because we've got another minute.
Well, this, I think, this song always moves me because it makes me think of course, it's the 70s, the 60s, and we're there. I mean, we're still there.
Where is there, though?
With what our government is doing in our name and other places around the world, we've got the people who are out on the streets again in even more numbers now, trying to force this corporate-dominated country that we live in to change and to just think about what's going on around us and.
But I don't want to be negative, but we are also there in that we are still the very extreme consumers that allow and require all of that negativity. We have not been able to step away from our consumerism. And until we can, I don't think any of the fighting is going to make any sense.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, in terms of the internal struggles as well as the external struggles. But no, I love this song. This is one of my favorites. Right. Here we go.
Thank you.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to.